And I was thinking about the metaphor of walking, and in the book, I was chapter today, and I was basically saying, if we can't find a way, essentially, to crack the climate conundrum, the environmental conundrum, the climate change challenge, in a way that makes us all feel like we're walking together, not solving a problem, but walking. When you take a walk, you don't take a walk to necessarily solve a problem, although you can. You could have a heart problem, and you take a walk to help solve that problem. But most of us take a walk, and in walking, which we enjoy, we're solving a problem, maybe in retrospect. We're solving a problem of boredom, restlessness, anxiety, a frustration, and maybe also a scientifically diagnosed, medically diagnosed heart condition. But the science problem has very little to do with any of us walk. And what we do, and what I do at Yale University and other universities, is we are working on developing strategies for to produce so what we call sustainability outcomes, or outcomes that are congruent with sustainability, in a way that enables people in a manner that makes them feel like they're walking, that they're actually having an experience that they want to have, an experience that rewards them, an experience that confers abundance, an experience that confers connectivity, and an experience that, yes, can even confer life extension. Okay? So the work that we do at Yale at the Science Communications with Impact Network, which I run, is we apply what's called systems thinking. You know, we apply systems thinking, which is essentially has been the domain of Earth system sciences for about 40, 50 years now. And what Earth system science obviously does, for those of you, I'm sure you all know, but Earth system science basically looks at the planet not as essentially the rock from the sun. But essentially looks at the Earth as a system of sort of, you know, people and planet, and a universe of multiple species and planets. And we know this scientifically. We know we're all connected. And that's not obviously just Gaian poetry. That is scientific theory moving towards, of course, scientific fact. But our communication approaches about what's going on the planet have lagged far, far, far behind the scientific discoveries of interconnectedness. We do not seek in our communication strategies to foster the kind of connectivity that we need in order to advance life on Earth. We instead insist upon communicating to people on climate change or related issues, the scientific facts and the importance, essentially, of protecting life on Earth. The problem is that leaves people out of the equation. People don't connect to that. And we're not seeking to connect people in that communication strategy to, in fact, planet conservation. We're relying unilaterally on the information to do the trick. And it's clear, we have 20, 30 years of research that indicate that the information will never do the trick, okay? Except for a very, very small portion of people at the top of the humanistic Abraham Maslow triangle, who are people who are self-fulfilled, people are already enlightened, people are already educated, people already have their needs met, and essentially can afford to take a planet-first approach. And for most of us in environmental media, the approaches that we are all taking are perceived and are experienced, are felt, and are reacted to as essentially an approach that will privilege planet over people. Never mind that approach, actually not taking that approach, will essentially bring the planet down. Doesn't matter. If you do not bring people to the task and the narrative and the story of saving the planet will go. Not going to happen, all right? And so our work really is about developing what we call narrative strategies and then building to network strategies. What we mean by that is narrative strategies that allow us to transpose climate change science into essentially nodes of engagement with people's values, people's ambitions, people's belief systems, number one. And then on the basis of those connections, those narrative connections, and the things that you care about, moving them to develop networks around essentially those stories that people ultimately want to tell about themselves, about their community, about their families, and about each other. And the albatross that has been particularly climate change, which is most of the focus of my work, that climate change is everything to everybody, and climate change is absolutely everywhere, which has been the challenge of what's called simple communications. How do you connect people to something that's so big, so monolithic, so omniscient, so ever-present, so much out of a human time scale? Well, how do you connect people to that? Well, the good news is the fact that it's everywhere is actually an opportunity for not just 6, but 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 degrees of separation to that everything that's everywhere. Okay? And it's our job, essentially, to essentially transpose environmental obligation as far as and responsibility into an ethos of reward. And that doesn't only mean reward business, right? That means rewarding to community, rewarding to family, rewarding to a sense of prosperity, affluence, and material connection to what matters for you. So at Yale, what we are doing is birthing what's called humanistic communications, which is exactly that. We use that term instead of environmental communications, which is basically makes the point of how of what is imperative is that we begin to connect environment to humanity's ambitions, aims, and dreams. And to begin with a little fun, now we don't have... I've given 5 talks today. I'm suddenly so tired. It's graduation, so yes, it's been endless, so I'm suddenly feeling it. And I'm looking at the time and trying to figure out... You're here till 7?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so am I. I'm trying to figure out... Okay, I'm going to go for the fun... This is not as substantive, so those of you who want more substance on the tools that we actually use and the projects that we are engaged in worldwide, if I don't get to that, we can all sort of convene by email or convene another time. But there's an example that we use, and that's with opera, okay? A comparison with opera. Opera was in a very similar position that climate science is in. Opera just 10 years ago was basically completely underfunded. No one cared about it. It was impossible to teach in schools. And it was considered the absolute bottom priority for a public and private school education. In the course of the past decade, of course, In the course of the past decade, that's entirely changed. The most rarefied, reified art form has become one of the most popular and well-funded music and art modalities in the world. That's true of particularly true of the inner city and inner cities around the world. And that is really due to an event that happened in 2001, an event that I find to be inspiring and instructive as to how we all ultimately can begin to imagine and begin to apply and implement a different approach on climate change. So opera is essentially also defined as an art form by its facts. You either accept the facts that define opera or you don't. And if you want essentially when people were trying to recruit, when the fans of opera and advocates of opera were trying to recruit people to the cause of saving opera, they would trot out these facts. What constitutes a tenor? What constitutes a soprano? What is the science of operatic singing as opposed essentially to the poetry of jazz? That's not far, of course, for the approach that we use for climate change. We seek essentially to communicate around the facts, and we define climate change by the facts. But something happened in 2002, and it was at the Grammys, at the start of the Grammys. And Andrea Bocelli was supposed to sing Nessun Dorma at the top of the Grammys. And on the way, he got lethally ill. And he said, I can't do it. I am going to the hospital, and someone else is going to have to open this show. Huh? Of course, everyone, the producers, all of everyone's ferreting around. Who can open the show? Grammys, we go live in half an hour. Is is some Beverly Sills protege here? What? Nobody. There in the wings, Aretha Franklin raises her hand. And she says, I'll sing it. And the entire establishment, producer, no one says no to Aretha Franklin, right? Mm-hmm. Well, Miss Franklin, have you ever sung opera? Nope. Mm-hmm. Nope. Do you sing Italian? Do you know Italian? Nope, not a word. You want some rehearsal? Nope. Just put the teleprompter up there, I'll figure it out, right? Well, no one knew what to do. She said, I'm going to do it. This is what happened. And as a result of what happened, okay, the entire opera world was turned around, and opera today, as I said, is the single most funded art form in the inner city around the world. What Aretha Franklin did for opera is also what she did for herself and for everyone else who experienced this event and was inspired by it. And then we'll talk about its transposition to climate change. Is a little tricky. This is making an investment here because this is 5 minutes worth spending, okay, as far as I know. So just go with the flow. And the fact that it's not every day that a speaker or the subject of the environment would begin with essentially a rendition of Nessun Dorma and Aretha Franklin singing Nessun Dorma is exactly to our point. This does not correspond to this, so this can get very tricky. Here we go.
Tremando d'amore.
can't do that for climate change, we're done. And what happened, as Aretha Franklin notes in her biography, is she essentially said, everything that they put in front of me was playing to my story. Nobody was going to tell a black woman that she couldn't sing opera. No one was not going to give me an opportunity to tell other children out there that they can ultimately make opera their own. No one ultimately was going to push me, Aretha Franklin, off the stage. I had something I needed and wanted to prove. She wanted, essentially, to make opera her own, okay? And the opportunity to essentially to step essentially to for opera to become an opportunity for her to step into a story that we all could relate to. A story when each of us feel we don't belong. Each of us feel that there is an elitist group, an elitist framework that we are not welcome to participate in. And the opportunity essentially for her, in her intuition, to essentially transpose essentially the world of opera into an opportunity for her to essentially experience opera in a way that was entirely her own, and for us to connect to that experience in a way that we could imagine making opera our own, is why opera now is in the position it is in public school and funding. An opportunity for particularly inner city students ultimately to reach out and essentially reach beyond and above their station and achieve something, break into a kind of and beyond a glass wall that ultimately doesn't include them. It's absolutely no different whether it's an opera glass wall or it's a planet that's in a museum. It's the same thing. And I'm here to tell you that there are strategies. We can't all be as intuitive, all right, as Aretha Franklin was. But there are specific strategies that enable us to accomplish that transposition. Home on the range, who can sing what? Home on planet Earth, who can belong to essentially the environmental movement and who can't? We forget with this Earthrise image, all of us, that this Earthrise image, when we look at it, we begin to think, ooh, fragile Earth, spaceship Earth, something ultimately that we need to protect. But when this image was first launched, this image from the very beginning was a radical image. And it was rejected by the scientific hegemony at the time. Because the scientific hegemony at the time was essentially owned by physicists. And physicists essentially then were on the side of progress. Okay? We're on the side of progress. Physicists essentially and engineers brought us to the moon. This was essentially the scientific establishment and the sort of consensus around what constituted progress were one and the same. Environmental scientists came along, okay, and they begin to essentially say, well, wait a minute. What is this thing we call progress? What is this thing we call Earth? It's fragile. We should take care of it. And this began essentially a process by which the establishment from the very beginning saw a critique of progress in the emergence of the environmental science. We don't know now that this image was actually suppressed for 4 years before it was released. Why? Because they knew it would be considered controversial. Okay, we just live with it now. We trot it out on Earth Day like it's something all of us are going to care about. We don't all care about it, right? For many of us, again, this represents it's the radical environmental terrorist who is essentially putting planet before people and encouraging us and urging us all to gather heuristically around the fragility of the planet. This, all of our communication strategies, ladies and gentlemen, have been focused on this. All of our strategies about how protecting the Earth, protecting the legacy of the Earth, protecting essentially what is underfoot, because obviously if we don't do that, we won't have a planet to live on. Respecting the planet, appreciating the planet, be kind to the planet. And those are called simple communications and communications parlance. That strategy belongs to the era which essentially puts the planet first and puts the image of the planet, of the fragile planet, first, and in so doing, represents manifestly a critique of the progress, and we are a critique of the progress by which and through which all of us define ourselves, particularly all our students at Yale. We all define ourselves by essentially this cult of progress. And this cult of progress is about separating people and planet. It is about conquering the Earth. And so what we work on at Yale is essentially transposing the simple communications about planet first to essentially a story and stories about what essentially people are doing around the world and then ultimately forming networks around this. This image back in the 70s tested very well for environmental narrative. This image now tests abysmally around the world again and again. People do not connect to it, but this image does. This image has people walking out of the studios or of the testing laboratories and they say, yes, this makes a difference. And it isn't simply because it's a human face that's put to climate change. It's because this suggests a story. People like the Aretha narrative look at this and their responses are, what would I do in that situation? Who is that little boy? Did he go back for his dog? Does his mother know? Would I go back for the dog? Is the dog aware he's being saved? What became of that boy? Well, one thing that did become of that boy, by the way, is he now is essentially the head of one of the most successful NGOs in the world for mangrove mangrove conservation. These kinds of opportunities, essentially, these kinds of opportunities to generate narratives about people, where people can imagine them stepping into Aretha's shoes, this boy's shoes, essentially it constitutes what we call the narrative approach. Always seek to tell a story with a beginning, middle, and end. And always seek, essentially, to give your listener and give your audience an opportunity to create a story that has a beginning, middle, and end. And if the end, ultimately, is something that's 400 years away or we'll never see in our lifetime, then it is incumbent upon us to transpose that 400-year timeline, that 1,000-year timeline, into what we call short-term rewards and short-term successes that will allow us, essentially, to act as if we care about those 400 years, but in reality, we really can't cognitively connect to it. So to skip through, since I only have, want to leave a few little bit of time for questions. Number one, number one is essentially there is an entire toolkit which we can share with you. It's publicly available, by which essentially you begin to. Focus on a strategy which is not about communicating something, but communicating to someone, okay? In systems thinking, what you do in systems thinking, in order for you to affect an environmental message that will ultimately sustain itself and go viral, there need to be essentially five constituents that belong to your environmental strategy, and all five of those represent and embody a different narrative. Those are your science audience, your policy audience, your community audience, which is about belief, your business audience, and your media audience. Every single one of those audiences, ladies and gentlemen, speak an entirely different language, which is constituted by an entirely different syntax and entirely different values. And for any environmental strategy, even if it's to put a bike lane in, the idea is to transpose that into undergirding it with a scientific message, transpose that into essentially the language of policy, belief, business, media, and community. And number one, the narrative strategy. Two, then, once you develop a narrative strategy and you begin to aggregate scientists, policymakers, community, and by the way, they do not need to all come together. This isn't about lowest common denominator strategies. This is about essentially creating different ecosystems with different purposes. And you are the one at the hub of this who is ultimately making sure that these various strategies ultimately remain congruent with each other as you move towards your goal. So the second is essentially to stop, to essentially really eviscerate your first stage strategy and to focus on the folks, the various constituents that you were involved, that you have engaged narratively as network. You don't see them as people anymore. You see them on their base. You see them solely on the basis of on the basis of their ability to connect to other people. Okay, and that does not involve narrative strategy. That involves essentially creating systems of rewards based on the narratives upon which you with which you have engaged them, right? And developing networks based on those systems of rewards. So number one is playing to, speaking to, the essentially language of business, language of policy, etc. Once you do that, then inhabiting that narrative with very specific rewards to each of those narratives that allow them essentially to tell a story with a beginning, middle, and end that will engage essentially, will enable them to engage their business community, their policy community, their the media community, etc. These are just more graphics. Symbiotic networks, we'll skip that. Humanistic communications, I'll race through the tools. Humanistic communications, essentially, really quickly, the primer, sits between information deficit. We have essentially, this constitutes the universe of environmental communications today. On the left is information deficit. That is the strategy that most of us use here. Communicate the facts, give people the information, and increase the information flow, and people will make responsible decisions by themselves. Doesn't happen, doesn't work, has not worked in 30 years, and we have not changed our strategy because we haven't had an alternative. The antidote to that is what's called information surfeit, which is what I did in media, Discovery Channel, etc. And it is don't play around with facts. Just give people adventure. Just give people thrills. Give them the day after tomorrow. Get them all jazzed. Get them all excited. But the problem with that is, number one, it's all based on sentiment. And as we all know from our sort of French film analysts who were abhorred sentimentality in film, sentimentality only lasts as long as you're actually in the experience. You walk out, you engage with the real world, and the sentimentality disappears. It's like willpower, basing a diet on willpower. Well, that only lasts until the next good cookie comes, and that's essentially like sentimentality. All right, so humanistic communications sits in the middle. This basically constitutes the Breakthrough Institute did a study of the of 10,000 environmental sort of research reports and environmental journalistic reports, and they mined it for the most commonly used words that ultimately define environmental narrative: stop, restrict, prevent, constrain, preserve, halt, reverse, regulate. Okay, this for most people is a nightmare. People struggling to survive. And Martin Luther King didn't say, I had a nightmare, he said, I had a dream. All right? And ultimately, we are trying, essentially, to form a network around a nightmare. And the way we're doing that is insisting on the, here's a tough one, insisting on the primacy of scientific truth and scientific objectivity. And what we have insisted, and I've done this, I did this for years, decades, where somehow we get it in our heads that by convincing people that there's real, universal, mostly universal scientific consensus on climate change, that somehow is going to wake people up and think, oh, well, if all those scientists agree on climate change and there's that much consensus, well, then I guess I'm going to just, I guess I better look again at what I believe. That has resulted even in the Huffington Post, when we essentially, like 350.org, when we start marching down 6th Avenue around a number, 350.org, we get this kind of a reaction. No one knows what it means. And it causes us, because we want to insist on just the obviously the importance of knowledge. But what that does is it corners us. It corners us into essentially communicating to those who don't buy into the knowledge, resist the knowledge, deny the knowledge as being morons, as being idiots. If you do not accept essentially the basic facts of knowledge, you must be an idiot. Look at the largest climate change march in history, unlikely to convince idiots. One other thing is we blame the media. We do a lot of media bashing, all right? We say, okay, all of this Fox News, he said, she said stuff. Because they're scared. Big media is scared. That's actually not entirely true. And even if it were true, by essentially accusing the media of being scared and stomping our feet, it doesn't really change anything. We just stomp our feet and we hang around and we hug trees and we hope that somehow big media is going to come around to our message. Well, actually, it all comes back to storytelling. And I, having been in the newsroom for many years, this is here. You're looking inside a newsroom, okay? And essentially, to what constitutes a story to warrant news attention, with the possible exception of a more ideologically, clearly ideologically driven newsroom like in Fox News, where some of this changes, but even here this applies, is that the story, the inputs, let's say it's climate change or let's say it's environmental work, ultimately need to come to the newsroom, and before it goes out, it must accommodate the mandates of the story must be novel, the story must be personalized, the story must be dramatizable, and it also must have some degree of balance and some degree of authority. Folks, this is all we occupy right now. Okay? Because that's all the facts can do. And everyone outside of those facts are idiots. Unfortunately, idiots are all here. Okay? So what Fox News and what I did in news, okay, is essentially say, oh, well, okay, if the scientists ultimately are not going to give us, if the data can't be dramatic, the data to drama, if the data ultimately can't be dramatic, and scientists can't figure out a way, or speakers on behalf of science can't figure out a way to transpose this data into dramatic narratives that can really connect with people, then screw it. We'll do it. We'll just add novel personalization and dramatization by bringing essentially the other side in, and we'll create a full circle of drama by essentially causing this kind of dueling heads. So to the he said, she said approach that we all abhor, because essentially it makes truth relative, we hold responsibility for that as well, for not having done our job. And why did we not do our job? Because we all, Yale, we fight this battle even at Yale constantly, because it is not the scientist's job, ultimately, to reach outside the realm of science and essentially communicate its applicability to people. It's not our job. We are all about objective. It's not our job to jump into policy. It's not our job to engage people. Well, how is that any different than the accusations we fling at business CEOs by basically saying, I'm only responsible to my shareholder? That's my job description. It's exactly the same. So to race you through 2 minutes of the tools just to kind of give you a sense of how we do this. This is essentially, really quickly, this is humanistic communications in a, these are, how does increasing carbon dioxide impact the choice that consumer makes, addressing where will we run when it hits, what will we grow, will we still get along, will I be free, will I be safe, will my home still even be here, will my wine taste the same, will my meat cost more, what will this new world look like, how much worse will the shoveling get, I don't believe in climate change, global warming. Well, we all need to start believing in global warming. Okay. Number one, in terms of engaging people on narrative. Very simple. You are essentially constructing a message to speak to people. The first thing you want to do is make sure that this message essentially hews to the group or groups that are coming to you, or people come to you and they say, I want help with a project. Number one. The sweet spot here is the intersection of passion, symbols, and facts. What are the facts ultimately undergirding your... Why do you need a bike lane? Why ultimately do we need to engage? Second, passion. Why do you want to do this? Why is this best for the community? Who can you engage that would be equally excited about it? And secondly, and very importantly, when all is said and done, what is the symbol ultimately? What do you want to be able to say symbolically about what you've done? These three, and we put people in workshops through exactly this strategy to start. Secondly, their narrative strategy must always seek to be at the intersection of belief and personal commitment and one's belief systems. Once you have essentially come up with what we call a meta-narrative, a story, the sort of the one-liner about what constitutes what we want to essentially put in a bike lane. You come up with essentially a one-liner, a two-liner, which reflects essentially the passion, fact, and symbols of the folks involved. Secondly, you break that down into science, media, policy, business, and belief languaging. How essentially can the, what, for example, we had a project, we have a project where we're essentially trying to develop a trying to create a home for a technology that captures carbon from the atmosphere and essentially applies it to greenhouses and farming. That became, through Passion Facts Symbols, a narrative about empowering local farmers to essentially enhance their growing season to 9 to 12 months, which currently was 6. That's the meta-narrative. Then that gets translated across science, media, policy, business, and belief. What essentially does that narrative mean to each of these, and how can we then engage them? You also can engage people personally, according to the Maslow Triangle, physiologically, safety, social esteem, and self-fulfillment. The only folks who respond to the science or anti-science narrative are at the top, the folks who are self-fulfilled, most of us in the room. You marry those to narratives as well, and what you find is, depending on where your community of people are at, worried about basic survival, basic safety, their social place on the ladder, their sense of self-esteem and self-fulfillment, different narratives ultimately correspond to different groups. You then, in terms of your network phase, you begin to focus on what is the experience that this group of stakeholders that are part of the story that they're telling to their communities. What is the experience they're delivering? What's the experience you're delivering to the business community, policy community, a belief community, the media community, etc.? That's the basis of your network. Networks deliver experiences. We don't have time to go through. These are the various network tools, etc., etc. In closing, since we ran out of time. It's hard, I know. Essentially, once you have done that, you focus on your narratives, and then you begin to develop networks of experiences around those narratives. You then basically begin to form and maintain a network that delivers on these experiences. And what that requires in closing is itself a series of tools and methods. Very specific tools by which you keep your campaign or your experience going that is congruent with the story that you are telling, that your folks are engaged and invested in. And essentially, the motivations here, money, glory, expertise, social being, the work that's satisfying, being a part of something bigger, and personal passion. These used to be one, I just changed it, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. These 8 essentially motivations are what are key to network building towards environmental sustainability and achieving sustainability outcomes. It is no different when you think about it as a Wikipedia page. The Wikipedia network has essentially one goal, okay? And that one goal is to grow pages, okay? And you grow pages based on essentially the heuristic of love and glory, not money in this case. Okay? And essentially the idea is to constantly be transposing your environmental work, your environmental narrative, your environmental goals into rewards that ultimately speak to people's core motivations, and it isn't that hard to do as Aretha Franklin demonstrates at the start of the Grammys. So yes, sorry, I thought we had 45 minutes, but at least it's 7 now. Yeah.
I don't think we're gonna kick out
next
time. No. Well, I didn't have to race through, but I have another dinner I need to go to anyway.
Thank you so much. Yeah. I'm sorry we were a little late getting started.
Any questions?
Will we be able to see some of your slides after tonight?
Sure. Well, first of all, they're posted on the Yale Science Communications with Impact Network site, which is it's Science Communications with Impact Network. They are posted there. I'm also happy to make them available to you. We also run workshops all the time. I mean, we currently are doing, we do very big projects at the moment. We're working with Virgin Airlines on essentially developing a network for biofuels for their jets, and we're actually developing a pilot for them. We work with the IPCC, Global Climate Science Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, on developing a business network, a science to business network And we're working with National Geographic to develop a collective intelligence network to save the oceans. Yes?
I think most of us in this room are working for the other folks in New Haven to understand this.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly am, and I think many of us are. And so we're, I think most of us are putting our, each other and our and other residents in our neighborhoods as the center of this conversation and making them the heroes of the narratives.
Mm-hmm.
There are
their stories.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if anybody in your group is interested in working with folks to do that
sure.
on a day in and day out basis.
Absolutely sure. I mean, we are doing that. For example, we have fleets of students now working in Dallas on a very specific project on southern Dallas on developing a sort of narratives of engagement for a sustainable Dallas on very specific goals. We're doing it in Newark. We're doing it in D.C. So that's one of the reasons when Lynn invited me, that was one of the reasons why I decided to take the time to come to let you aware that there is this resource here. We have 80 students in the program, and we can carve a project for them for which they can get credit. Okay, because I don't imagine New Haven has the kind of money it takes to hire me. So instead, we can move to essentially a workforce that the students can be invest in. So we can construct a project, a specific project. Yes.
Yeah, my first thought is, can we get Aretha Franklin to sing about climate change?
Yes. That's what we're talking about, okay? and there's no question. And when we have more time, we have basically 30, 40 projects going around the world. And we have one project right now, for example, in China, which is in my private practice, which is they have the same challenges we do, even though they can mandate these goals. And their problem is they can't get the ministerials to give a whit about climate change. So what we're doing is developing a strategy where the climate goals and the carbon drawdown goals can be ride piggyback and ride herd on the black soot and pollution drawdown goals so that those, in fact, become one of the same. Another one is a farm network that we're developing in Maine, New Hampshire, and New York, which is around, get this, around soil health, right? And the importance of soil health in playing a big role in climate drawdown and in playing a big role in climate drawdown, also enhancing and empowering local farmers and their ability to produce. So you have this heuristic where essentially climate action is connected to local food organizations, and then you connect those local food organizations globally via a network. And you then tend to have impact. And already what's happening is technologies and data is being developed so that all of those farmers can have the same information about soil health and the ability of carbon, the ability of good soil health to draw down carbon, and the impact that that not only has on more farming productivity, but the ultimate role farming can play in climate health, which isn't even on the radar presently. And that's an example of bringing people. These farmers in upstate New York and New Hampshire and Maine, they don't care about climate change. They care about productivity. So we're developing the tools that allow them to leverage their productivity into a climate change outcome.
So would you mention climate change to them or not?
Well, to some who care about it enough, but mostly it's about essentially leveraging soil health to improve their productivity and improve their opportunity for abundance. Or even in the greenhouse, for example, it's about extending their growing season. In order to extend their growing season, they need CO2 essentially pumped in, and we capture the CO2 outside their greenhouses with these tiny little modulars that capture CO2. And that's then they essentially engage around climate, based on the fact that climate awareness and climate education is connecting them to a greater opportunity to participate in the farming ecosystem and productivity. So we don't lead, we don't, never, never, my students don't even use the word climate change. No. We always say, stop asking what you can do for climate change and start asking what addressing climate change can do for you. Just forget it. People don't get it. It's a monolithic, it's a monolithic idea. Yes, and then yeah.
So then at what point do you then take the story and then talk about climate change?
You don't have to.
But then... So
you don't have to, okay? You can aggregate essentially a strategy up to have a climate impact. none of those farmers in particular that are suddenly finding the opportunity for them to improve the ability of soil to capture carbon. And then, go ahead.
But I'm saying not with the farmers, because they may not care. As I understand that they're more interested in productivity. But do you tell the story to someone else that might could care about climate change?
It's not that we don't. It's not like there's a gag rule, you know, on it. It's ultimately, but the point is, it's not. It is like asking people to take action on an idea. Okay, and for people like you, you can take action on that idea. Most people can't. What they can see, for example, is you're a farmer. You have more drought. You have drought issues. You have extreme, storms. You have flooding. You have all of these issues. Now, you may not care about climate change. Got it. Okay. But the fact of the matter is the uncertainty, ultimately, that surrounds that climate. The uncertainty that surrounds climate science is connected to the uncertainty ultimately that is related to your productivity. Okay. And so at the end of the day, do you want to make a bet against climate ultimately continuing to advance? Not if it means more flood, not if it means more drought, and moreover, that's not enough. It's got to be if also addressing climate change via these various technologies and modalities that make it easy for you, you're more productive. You can shake your head all you want, but that whole thing about climate, nobody gets it.
Oh, I know that.
And that's why you don't know that, because you don't know that unless you let go of it. And it's really hard.
But I would think that farmers would get it a whole...
They don't.
Gardeners get it. Why wouldn't farmers get it?
They don't get it. What they get ultimately is... The only thing ultimately that matters is not the climate change. And I'll give you an example. The only thing that matters ultimately to the farmer is not essentially the global cause of climate change. Because the global cause of climate change and addressing climate change is not, they're not going to feel the impact of that, the effects of that in their lifetime or in their kids' lifetime or their grandkids' lifetime. What they will feel, okay, is an opportunity basically to address. By virtue of addressing climate change, the opportunity to address soil health, the opportunity to become more productive, the opportunity to engage and invest in data that will allow them to succeed. The fact that that technology ultimately is based on the fact that climate change ultimately will continue to advance is beside the point. We need to be the transposers. We sit here in our offices and somehow think that by telling people about climate change that we can convince them to care and take action. No, we need to tell them, show them, demonstrate to them what it means to take action. Invest in data technology. Invest in very specific, ultimately, approaches that will allow them to essentially understand what that means. And it's work. We need to roll up our shirt sleeves and essentially do the work. And that is different from marching on behalf of a number. Marching on behalf of a policy that's never going to happen. Marching on behalf of a Paris Agreement. Developing networks and modalities of action that ultimately impact, that ultimately deliver a impact, a climate change drawdown impact, is ultimately what's called polycentric networks of change. You know, our institutions aren't going to do this, but polycentric networks of influence will. Okay, and we have one more question.
You got time?
Yeah, go ahead. Whatever. I'm late anyway, so yeah.
One thought was, one element you talk about was the passion.
Yes.
Which is very easy to get people to engage in. A lot of, and where I'm going with this is that what I see a lot from, whether it's from the environmental side or from building a wall and immigration policy, whatever policy you want to have, the element that engages passion seems to be the most is fear. Mm-hmm. Politics of fear. And I think a lot of the climate arguments are fear-based, and I'm not sure that how that passion strategy fits into your model here.
Doesn't fit.
Well, you have it as one of your three.
I have passion, facts, and symbols, ultimately. But at the end of the day, if you come to, like I said, you can't organize. One of the core tenets of humanistic communications is you can't. I had a nightmare, I had a dream. One of the core tenets, essentially, is that passion in order to engage people symbolically in passion that is consistent with the facts, that at the end of the day, what you need to do mostly is basically deliver on rewards. And it's really hard. It's really ultimately hard to transpose, you know, the doomsday of climate change into the deliverance, you know, of rewards. So at the end of the day, we are not about fear-mongering, okay? And yes, and also fear-mongering is sort of like sentiment. That only lasts as long as you're scared. And the fact of the matter is, climate change can scare you only as long as you and I succeed to scare me. I go outside. Okay, so 400 years from now, well, 100 years from now, or 6 months from now, there'll be no, or 20 years from now, there'll be no glaciers. Got it, I'm really scared. Okay, now I'm going to go about my life. You can't stay scared about something that is so, it's not like there's a boogeyman in your closet, right? So that just that kind of passion ultimately is not consistent with a campaign or initiative that ultimately will enable you to go back and say, when I was done, what did I deliver on? Right?
So, like, we don't have Aretha Franklin, but, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio has the movie, you know, Before the Flood.
Yeah.
It seems like it engages in that type of synthesis of those ideas that you talked about.
Yes, it does. And so does one other thing. For you to interrupt you, WALL-E. Watch WALL-E again. WALL-E is classic humanistic communications. And I was involved in WALL-E and that narrative strategy in WALL-E. Okay? And if you go back and look at what WALL-E really does and what it really takes for WALL-E to save life on Earth, okay, he's not really chasing Eve around with a little plant he wants to save. He's chasing her with a little plant that he wants to give to her because he loves her. And that little plant, which he bestows upon her because he loves her, is the key, ultimately, to the regenesis that WALL-E is really all about. And WALL-E, by the way, is in mid-total detritus, collecting junk. He's a trash compactor. And he's happy as a clam, whistling while he does it. Because WALL-E inside is essentially living a kind of story of resurrection and a story of regenesis. And WALL-E, ultimately, is also not, when he's collecting stuff, he's collecting amid that detritus. What is he collecting? Consumer items. All right? The things that we associate of ultimately with the, you know, end of the year, plastic bottles, little trinkets, little rubric cubes. He's not at all in a position of demonizing, essentially, consumerism. What he's doing and what he's in the process of doing is changing, essentially, that detritus and that consumerism into something that is completely better and that is driven by a love of someone else and connecting to someone. If you watch it beat by beat by beat by beat, slowly, you'll basically see a mirror image of the talk that I just gave. Mm-hmm. Yeah, watch it. Okay, good.
Yeah, it's really nice.
Thank you.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you so much.
Sure.
Yeah.
Is there an opportunity to donate to one of your...
Yes, we'd love that. We do, certainly. We take donations at the Yale. You just contact me email. That would be lovely. Anything at all to support our work. And if you do have a project, ultimately, that you want to work on, I know the city of New Haven, Mayor Harp's office had a project that she was interested in engaging with, which I don't know what it is yet. My TFs have found out as well.
On mentioned
so you can talk about that. Okay, there you go. That didn't take long. Okay, great.
Wow. Well, apologize to the people we
meet.
Well,
that's also me. I mean, you guys, this is 3 years of teaching into 37 minutes, so I know it's a lot.
I know. I was like this. I got to go back and look at your website.
Yeah.
All right. Things that... I'm like, wait a second.
it's a lot. But it does involve letting go of pushing climate change, and I know you struggle with that. We all do. But that's a tough one, you know. Focus on transposing climate into meaningful modes of action and change, and we will begin to see different outcomes is the whole thesis of the work.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
I would love to talk to more.
Okay, sure. Just email me. Okay, great. Okay, bye.
So you guys want to talk about it at all? Or? You probably have reactions. It's sort of like it took me a little bit longer in his
information.